From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday. More than 40 years ago, Midwesterners Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax created Dungeons & Dragons, a fantasy role-playing game, and its oddly shaped dice thrusts kids and adults into a world of mythical creatures, forgotten realms, and magical treasure. Journalist David Ewalt says the wildly popular and often satirized game was more than just a refuge for socially awkward teens. It had a major influence on how games are designed today. He's written a book about the history of D&D and his experiences returning to the game he loved as a child. He joins us to talk about the legacy and impact of the game. His book is called Of Dice and Men. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday, in for Doug Fabrizio. In the 1970s and 80s, Dungeons & Dragons was at the height of its popularity. The game introduced a whole new world of entertainment to America. Instead of board games that had a clear objective and end, D&D was an ongoing adventure where players embodied characters who would embark on long campaigns to slay mythical beings and acquire magical treasure. The game ignited the imagination of its players. But D&D also received its share of criticism. It was quickly stereotyped as a refuge for socially awkward teens, and some even tried to link the game to satanic cults and adolescent suicide. But Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson couldn't imagine the influence their creation would have on how games are produced today and social dynamics in the 21st century. David Ewalt is a journalist who writes about technology and games for Forbes. He fell in love with D&D as a kid and has now returned to playing the game as an adult. His new book is called Of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons and Dragons and the people who play it. Are you still playing D&D? Why do you prefer role-playing games over video or online games? Join the conversation. The phone number is 801-585-WEST. That's 801-585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. You can also chime in on Facebook and Twitter. David Ewalt joins us from a studio in New York City. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, I want to get into lawful good and hit points and armor class and all the minutia of Dungeons & Dragons, but I know there are some people out there listening who aren't familiar with D&D, so let's start with the basics. How does Dungeons & Dragons work?
I like to describe it to people as a kind of collaborative storytelling. It's a game, but it's important not to think of it as something like Monopoly or Scrabble that's very limited and locked into a set of rules that are printed on a single sheet of paper. At its heart, what D&D is you and a group of friends are sitting down at a table and telling a story together where you are the heroes of that story. So you play different roles in that hero. One of you might be a knight. One of you might be a wizard. And there's usually a person who directs the story. And that's what kind of keeps it just from being pure make-believe. There are rules, and there is a guy who's kind of in charge, who's the referee of the whole game. And he's the one that tells you, okay, well, if you want to knock down that door, you're going to have to roll some dice.
So take me back to the point in your life when you discovered the game. I imagine it's probably around the same time I discovered the game in the 1980s. Talk to me about that time in your life and why the game was so attractive to you at that time.
Well, I was about 10 years old when I first discovered the game. I had been introduced to it by a friend. You know, we were just over at his house playing around, you know, as 10-year-old boys do, probably breaking stuff. And he said, "Hey, I found this game of my brother's. Do you guys want to play it?" And had a big picture of a dragon on the front of it. So we were all like, "Yeah, that looks awesome." I think what appealed to us about the game was that it was like nothing we'd ever seen before. It isn't like static board games in that you can do whatever you want. You can be the hero and you can have the game move in strange ways wherever your imagination takes you. And I think to a little kid, that's really appealing because you're now creating an entire universe. And a kid especially, you know, so much the world is being put upon you. You're being told what you can and cannot do. Kids definitely respond to the freedom that comes with Dungeons & Dragons.
And you left the game for a little while. So you played it during adolescence, according to your book. You left it for a little while in college, but you came back to it as an adult, and you're playing it now actively, right? What brought you back to the game? Let's start with what made you sort of exit from the game for a while, and what brought you back to it?
Well, I did play the game, you know, through my entire childhood up through high school. I mean, it was what I did with my friends. You know, every weekend we'd get together and we'd play role-playing games, not just Dungeons & Dragons, but also the games that D&D gave birth to. When I graduated from high school and went off to college, you know, as kids so often do, I wanted to reinvent myself. And the fact is that D&D, you know, exists within a certain very nerdy subculture. So I said to myself, oh, I'm going to be a different guy when I get off to college. I'm not going to be that nerdy kid anymore. So I stopped playing and I went on to find different things. But the game gets in your blood. And years later, you know, I found myself thinking about it more and thinking about how fun those sessions were. And then I you know, became a technology reporter. I was writing about the world of tech and sometimes about games for Forbes magazine. And when I started meeting people in the video game industry, I would talk to executives and I would talk to designers who make video games. And I would say to them, well, why are you doing this? What made you want to go and make video games for a living? And over again, they told me, oh, I played a lot of Dungeons & Dragons when I was a kid. And that made it clear to me that, you know, there's more to this game than I realized when there was a kid, and I need to go and start playing it again. And I found a game online and met some guys who played weekly and fell in back into it very quickly.
So in your book, you sort of interweave the history of Dungeons & Dragons with your own experiences playing with this group of guys that you found online. And I want to talk a little bit about the social dynamics of that group. First of all, I think we should lay out that the D&D has the characters have specific classes, right? And your character named Westlock is a cleric. For our listeners, tell us what a cleric is and talk about some of the other players in the group and what sort of identities they take on in the game.
Well, to start with, a cleric is basically a wizard. They're a magician. It's a pretty familiar type. But clerics, as opposed to other magicians, clerics focus on healing magic. So your role in an adventure group, cleric is going to heal the other players when they get hurt. So if you go into combat and, you know, a dragon bites your friend, the cleric's going to come in and heal that wound. These things, like clerics and the other classes, these are really they're the fantasy archetypes that you see in every fantasy novel, movie. I mean, it's the thief, the wizard, the ranger, the cleric. I mean, they're very closely drawn from things like The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and the Conan the Barbarian books. And those archetypes are interesting within the game, not just because, oh, you know, we need a Gandalf and we need an Aragorn, but also because the players themselves sitting at the table take on some of that archetype. And so you have this interesting social dynamic of, hey, I need your help, I'm hurt, or, ooh, this monster's going to eat me, but I can't defend myself, so I need you to come in and protect me. And it creates this interesting dynamic between the players that also bonds them pretty quickly.
Talk to me about the other guys that you play with and what characters and classes that they embody and how that helps with the dynamics of the group, because D&D is a group effort, right? And it's not just a game that one person plays.
Yeah, the game is pretty unique in that it's a cooperative game. Everybody sitting at the table is working together. There's no winner necessarily. It's not like, oh, I got more points than you guys, I came out on top. So at the table of the campaign I write about in the book, there's me, I play a cleric who's kind of the magician who does healing magic. We have a ranger in the game. His name is Jaden. He's sort of the Aragorn character from Lord of the Rings. He's, you know, a fighter, but he's very comfortable in nature and he can track things. We have a thief. It's kind of the classic fantasy thief who is less about stealing stuff and more about, you know, being able to open locks and pry open doors and being very sneaky and stealthy. That's Graham is our thief in the game. We have a bard, which is one of these slightly more unusual character classes. D&D bards are storytellers, but they use magic too. And it's an interesting kind of spin also taken from literature. The way to think about bards is that they're kind of like the Pied Piper. They play music, but their music manifests itself in the real world magically. So, you know, a bard in a fight might start playing some music to sort of hypnotize the monster so the other players can swoop in and attack him.
So when you're looking at your group, are you looking for specific classes, someone to be a ranger, someone to be a cleric or a magic user or even a bard? I mean, when you're looking at what group is going to make the best sort of group in the campaign, what kind of classes are you looking for?
It is very important when you're playing one of these games to get the balance of players right. Because if you go into an adventure and you only have 5 bards, you're not going to get anywhere. You need a certain depth of skills and abilities. So when people come to play this game, there's frequently a bit of horse trading when you first start of like, okay, you be the wizard, I'll be the cleric, you'll be the thief. And a lot of people have actually said if they're playing the game that they learn a lot about kind of working together with a group and how to share roles and a lot of group dynamic stuff that are frequently useful in workplaces because, you know, every time you do a project at work, you can't have everybody be, you know, the lowest rung on the totem pole. There needs to be somebody who's in charge. There needs to be somebody who's organizing. And it's a very similar sort of dynamic.
So we talked about the players. There's a person in the game called the Dungeon Master who facilitates the game, facilitates the adventure. For our listeners, talk about that person, what role that person plays in this whole scenario.
The role of the Dungeon Master is really important because if you didn't have somebody who was directing this whole game, it would just be wild fantasy. It would just go off into the weeds very quickly. So the job of the Dungeon Master is twofold. One is that he's directing the story, very much like a director in a film. He's kind of coming up beforehand with a plot, with details of, okay, the players are going to come and their quest today is going to be that a king has asked for their help, that he needs them to kill a dragon that's been burning up all the crops in his fields. Once he's decided that plot, he then sort of narrates the game to the players. He tells them, all right, the king has called you into his antechamber, and the king says to you, welcome, brave adventurers. So sometimes it's literally like that, that he's telling you what's happening in the world around you. But he's also negotiating the rules. So when the players do find that dragon and your fighter says, I want to rush in and hit with my sword, the Dungeon Master is the guy who's going to consult the rule books and say, okay, in order for you to hit that dragon with your sword, you're going to have to take that die and you're going to have to roll a number or higher. So he's the guy who's refereeing. He's the guy who's telling the story and he's the guy who's moderating the whole experience.
The dice are kind of an iconic image of Dungeons & Dragons. There's, I believe, 6 of them, right? And you've got everything from a 6-sided die to a 4-sided die to a 20-sided die. I've even seen, I think, 30-sided die. I don't know if those are used in D&D or not anymore. But The dice are a really important part of the game. Talk to me about that and how rolling dice makes those kinds of decisions in the game. Because the rules from a distance can seem pretty difficult and pretty mechanical.
Yeah, the dice are very important. The dice at their heart, the dice are introducing an element of randomness. The dice are luck. So I can be the weakest character in the world, but when I swing my sword at something, there's always a chance that I'm going to hit that creature just right and kill it. I could also be the strongest barbarian the world has ever seen, and when I hit somebody, the sword bounces off their hide and I drop it and it goes flying across the room. That's what the dice do. Every time I try to do some sort of action that really draws upon skill, I'm going to roll that dice and add that number that comes up onto my skills or whatever else that I'm trying to do that event. And the dice are going to help me do it or sometimes hurt me from doing it. It adds an element of chance and of luck to the game that is really important because otherwise you could just look at the page and your character and say, well, you know what? I'm really strong. So every time we see a monster, I'm just going to run in and stab it. There would be no risk to you because you know, all right, I'm strong. I will always kill these monsters. But the dice say otherwise, that sometimes you're going to go in and you're going to drop your sword. They also become kind of a fetish object in a little way. Like when you're playing this game that's very imaginary, that exists inside your head, it's nice to actually have something there on the table to pick up these solid, weird-shaped dice. And when you roll them, it's such a physical experience, and you get that tense moment when you're watching it roll across the table and waiting for it to come up. It draws you back into the physical world and gives you something to concentrate on.
So Dungeons & Dragons really is a game that never ends in a sense, right? And I guess unless characters die in certain worlds or certain scenarios, but campaigns can go on for weeks, even months, and the Dungeon Master often, as you point out in your book, there are sort of these pre-made Dungeons & Dragons adventures. When I played the game, they were called modules, but a Dungeon Master worth his salt is one who creates the campaign for himself. Is that you sort of talk about how that's a more attractive scenario in the game.
In my experience, the games that people really enjoy and like to be in are the ones where people call them a campaign. And it's where the Dungeon Master has invented a world or a storyline, and he's telling it out and unfolding it over many, many games for the players. I've met players that have been in campaigns for decades. I've met people who started with a Dungeon Master in the 1970s. They've been playing the same character ever since. And it creates this sense of epic adventure, that it's not just, okay, we're going to sit down, you know, for a video, like a video game, you might sit down and you can play for 2 hours or even 30 or 40 hours, but then it's over and you move on to something else. Because these games have no clear end, you might have the same character that, you know, sure, we helped the king and killed the dragon, but now the king says, oh, my enemies, the other kingdom on the other side of the mountains, I want you to go check them out. Then after that, there's another quest, and you really start to associate with this character, and it becomes such a classic fantasy adventure that people really get drawn to that experience.
David Ewalt, his book is called Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons and Dragons and the People Who Play It. We have to take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday, in for Doug Fabrizio. My guest today is David Ewalt. He's a journalist at Forbes, and he's written a new book about Dungeons & Dragons. It's called Of Dice and Men. Let's go into a little bit of the history of Dungeons & Dragons, because I think that's really the strongest part of your book. I learned so much about Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, who were kind of mythical characters to me when I was a kid playing the game. I always wanted to visit the dungeon in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, but I never got there. But you talk a lot about what the genesis of Dungeons & Dragons was, and it started evidently with a group of guys who were interested in recreating military battles, historic military battles on a board, right?
Yeah, the game grew out of communities, mostly in the Midwest and in the Great Lakes region, of guys who were really into war games. And these were games that a lot of them were descended from very explicitly martial games, you know, that had been run by armies for centuries of, we're going to simulate a battle to see what happens. But these guys were playing all kinds of different war games where you'd have entire armies on the board. Napoleonic battles were very, very common, where you'd have cannons and musketeers and halberdiers, and you'd simulate these big battles that actually happened in history. These games were very popular among this subculture, but these guys who were playing them looked at them and said, well, we love these, but we want to, you know, how can we make them different? How can we experiment with them? And the thing about war games was that you might have a musketeer on the table, but it wasn't a musketeer. That figure represented an entire platoon of musketeers. It represented 100 soldiers. So that's how you had a whole battle happening on a tabletop. And some of these players there in the Great Lakes area started saying, well, what if instead of controlling entire armies, entire platoons of musketeers, what if I was only controlling a single musketeer, a single hero? And so they started experimenting with ways to do this game where now it's not so much about an entire battle and about recreating history, but now I'm playing a hero and I'm in the adventure and we're going to have a story that we're going to try to play out, and we're going to try to solve a mystery or kill a monster or save a princess. And the fantasy elements quickly started coming in after that, and it was an entirely new kind of game. This idea of fantasy role-playing was something that had never been seen before the early 1970s.
So the two men credited with creating Dungeons & Dragons are Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson. They both sort of brought different things to the game. Their friendship was the manifestation for the game, but then they had a falling out. Let's talk about Gary Gygax first. Tell me who he was, where he came from, what prompted him to begin creating the game.
Well, Gary Gygax was born in Chicago, and then when he was young, moved to a place called Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. The best way to describe Gary is really that he was a gamer. He grew up playing games and loving games. He played lots of these war games. He played board games. He played some familiar games. People might be familiar with Avalon Hill, who made a game called Gettysburg, or a French game, which we know is Risk. So it was stuff like that that Gary was really into. He jumped around a lot between careers and never really settled into one, because what he really wanted to do with his life was make games for a living. So eventually, by the early 1970s, he said, you know what, that's what I'm going to do. He quit his job. You know, he started cobbling in his basement. He'd fix shoes just to help pay the bills, and started developing these new kinds of war games and rule supplements and selling them off to different publishers. It was his idea that, you know what, I could make a run of this. I could make new kinds of games that people like me would really be into and would buy.
Did he see a huge market for it, or in the beginning, was it just a way for him to satisfy his own appetite for these kinds of games?
I think it was a little bit of both. Gary was definitely looking to satisfy his own appetite. I think he would have made games even if he had thought no one will ever buy these, just because it was what he wanted to do. It was his passion. But he was also very savvy and very aware of the marketplace and of the potential of these games. So when he first started developing Dungeons & Dragons and the things that would become Dungeons & Dragons, he knew there was a market and he intended to serve it. Now, that said, I don't think he ever early on at that point really understood the potential market. This game grew far larger than his imagination would have allowed him to believe at that point when he first started. But he knew that there was a market there, and he did plan to make money and have a business out of it.
So who was Dave Arneson, and how? What role did he play in present-day Dungeons & Dragons?
So Dave Arneson similarly was a gamer. He was up near the University of Wisconsin. He was part of this community of war gamers up there that were really experimenting with war game rules. It was a group of players up there that first started that idea of, well, you know, what if we do a single character instead of a player? Dave Arneson was one of the guys that first put in the fantasy setting. He invented this castle called Blackmoor, and he created dungeons underneath it full of monsters and treasures and sent his players down there to explore. Dave was not maybe as interested in starting a business and selling the game as Gary would be, but Dave was similarly, you know, very much interested in experimenting and figuring out, well, what can we do with this? What kind of new game can we come up with? How can we improve the rules? And just how can we come up with more cool stuff to do with our friends?
And so Gary and Dave came together to begin what became Dungeons & Dragons, but the game itself, and I'll talk a little bit more about the company in a second, but the game itself sort of evolved into a different set of rules over periods of time. How did Gary and Dave make the game accessible? When I was involved in the game, the biggest obstacle for me was understanding the rules. I mean, it's a very complex game. How did they sort of overcome that and make it accessible to folks?
Well, it's true. And the addition that Gary and Dave are really credited with both working on, the original Dungeons & Dragons rules, were very inaccessible. Even other wargamers, people who were within that community, really had a hard time understanding those rules and figuring out how to play the game. The important things that happened to make the game more accessible came a little later in the game's history, and one of them was and some outside people came in. There was a doctor who was a gamer, very into the hobby, a guy by the name of J. Eric Holmes, who came into the company and said, you know what, I like this game, it's really cool, but I don't, you know, people have a hard time understanding it. Let me rewrite the rules and simplify them. And he created an edition of the rules called the Dungeons & Dragons Basic Set. And that's what it was. It was basic. It was much easier to understand. It was the kind of thing now where children could pick it up and be like, oh, okay, now we know how to play this. The company also did a lot of other interesting things to pull people into the experience. One of them was, you know, you talked earlier about these modules, which were sort of the pre-written adventures. That was really important to get people into it, because if you just hand them the rules, people had never seen a game like this. They didn't know how to tell a story. They didn't know how to direct this sort of strange collaborative thing. But the modules that were sold by the company allowed them to sit down and sort of read it like a script and say, okay, you're the dungeon master. This is what you're going to tell your players. This is what their mission is. These are the monsters they're going to face. And it spelled things out for them and made the game accessible in a way that really pushed it into the mainstream because so many people were now able to get it.
So it was the basic Dungeons & Dragons set that made it accessible to a larger audience, and that's really when TSR, the company that Gygax formed, took off. It seemed overnight that TSR, there were Dungeons & Dragons games in Gary Gygax's basement that he couldn't sell, and then all of a sudden they couldn't print enough editions and keep them on the shelves of hobby stores and toy stores. What sparked that transition? Was it the basic set?
Well, the thing that really – and the basic set was important, I mean, because it did make the game more accessible. But there was a single moment where the game went from being sort of a niche product, you know, that war gamers went to it. The thing that really pushed the game mainstream was kind of a surprising happenstance, which was there was a young kid, a teenager, who was – a young genius. He graduated from high school early. He went off to college when he was only like 16. And his name was James Dallas Egbert. And when he went off to college, he was young and didn't know anybody. He was kind of alienated from his friends. And he was, you know, as you often see with this kind of young genius, he was frequently depressed. So he went off to college and started to make some friends among this small cadre of people who played these war games and role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons. But then he ran into a bout of depression. He got depressed again, and he ran away from school. Now, when that happened, the campus officials and his parents went and tried to figure out what had happened to him. And they went to his room, and they found these weird rule books that had pictures of dragons on them and lists of spells, and they didn't know what they were. No one had ever really heard of Dungeons & Dragons before. So they jumped to the rather unnatural conclusion that Egbert had been playing this game, Dungeons & Dragons, and had come under a spell or had lost his mind while playing the game, that the game had driven him to madness and that he was now maybe lost in the tunnels underneath the campus, or that he'd run off somewhere, or that he'd been killed by another player. It was this really crazy, sensationalistic story. It wasn't true, of course, but it was a great story to tell, and so the media picked up on it immediately. It became a national news story. It was on newspapers. It was on the nightly news programs all over the country. And of course, when that happened, you then had kids and college kids, people all over the country are now reading these stories about, wow, there's a game out there that is so good that it can make you go crazy. That made people want to play that game more than anything else. So within a few weeks, and especially by the end of that year when this news came out, the game was everywhere. That's what thrust it into the mainstream, and that's what got people excited to play it.
But this element of taboo, the hysteria around Dungeons & Dragons grew into the mid-1980s. You have a fascinating chapter in your book that you call The Satanic Scare, which talks about that perceived link of the game between satanic cults or teenage suicide. And one of the first situations you mentioned in the book happened in Heber City, Utah. Of course, we're broadcasting out of Salt Lake City. So what can you tell me about the Heber City incident that happened in 1980?
Well, it was not an uncommon thing in that there was various places around the country where there would be crimes or, you know, sometimes murders, a cop getting shot, or kids going missing, teen suicides too. And what would happen is when the police would go to investigate. Now, this comes after the James Dallas Egbert case, so it was already in people's minds. They didn't really know what D&D was, but they knew it had something to do with this weird disappearance of this kid. So in all these cases in Heber City, it happened in Texas, it happened in South Carolina. I mean, it happened all over the country and also all over the world. There were cases like this in England too. The police would go to investigate a crime, and if they found Dungeons & Dragons rule books, that would suddenly become an important fact of the case. You would see police reports from the time report that a suspect played Dungeons & Dragons the same way they might say, oh, the suspect is a known drug addict, or the suspect, you know, is it alcoholic and has been drinking all day before he committed the crime. If they knew he'd been playing Dungeons & Dragons before he went out and committed this crime, that was obviously the thing that made him commit the crime. And so it just built upon itself, and it became the narrative in the media of every time there was a crime, D&D was involved, so therefore D&D is the cause. When the reality was just a lot of these teen crimes, D&D was there at the site. The kids had the rule books because it was a popular game among kids. It was a false move of logic there saying, oh, we found the rule books on this kid who's a criminal, so therefore the rule books caused him to be a criminal. No, he has the rule books because he's a kid, and it's a really popular game among kids.
This hysteria, though, even made it into mainstream culture. You mentioned, and I remember this movie back in the 1980s, Mazes and Monsters, which dramatized starred a young Tom Hanks as a person who sort of went off the deep end and became his Dungeons and Dragons character and ended up in a mental institution. It's sort of a kind of a funny cult film now, but I mean, did films like Mazes and Monsters and Ed Bradley's report on 60 Minutes in the mid-1980s, did it have a positive effect or a negative effect on Dungeons & Dragons? And how did Gary Gygax react to that kind of criticism?
Well, if it had a positive effect, it's that, I mean, it did sell a lot of games. So I'm sure the TSR, the publisher, was very happy at least about like, well, more people are playing the game. And a lot of people have a very positive experience with the game, and they say they get a lot out of it. So you can also draw that logic that, you know, this negative news gave a lot of people a game that they really value and is important for them. But it was negative in a lot of ways because it tainted the game. True or not, the people who play the game started to be painted as deviants, as weirdos, as Satan worshipers, as troublesome. And so, you know, these otherwise innocent kids and frequently, you know, quite intelligent kids who were into this sort of game started to feel marginalized and started to feel like, well, you know, people don't understand me. People just want to come down on me and say, you know, then tell me what I'm doing is wrong. And so I think it hurt a lot of kids and certainly hurt, you know, a lot of subcultures that way. That's been a reputation and an effect that gamers are still trying to shake off, even though people don't still talk about Dungeons & Dragons being literally satanic. There are still lots of gamers out there, particularly fantasy role-playing gamers, who feel like people look at them like they're doing something wrong.
How did you deal with sort of the nerd stigmatism of that as a kid, and did that keep you from coming back to it as an adult? Or let's start, I guess, with how you dealt with it as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a teenager, I sort of embraced it in as much as, you know, I was a nerdy kid and I didn't want to be much else. I was okay with being nerdy, and I really liked playing Dungeons and Dragons, and I really liked computers and all the other stuff that I played around with. And so I just did them. It was only when I started to get older, and you know, when you start to get in high school and you're more concerned about your image and how people perceive of you, that I started to think about, well, you know, am I painting myself as a nerd? You know, am I never going to be able to break out of this subculture? Are people going to always think that I'm somehow, you know, undesirable or geeky if I keep playing these games? One of the experiences that's been really rewarding for me actually coming back to Dungeons & Dragons all these years later and playing again has been to sort of re-embrace that part of myself and be able to say, yeah, I'm a geek. These are geeky games. That's why they're awesome. It's nothing to be embarrassed about. It's the thing that we like about them, and that's awesome.
I want to get back a little bit into the history of Dungeons & Dragons with Gary Gygax, because the company was wildly successful. Games were being sold everywhere, but inside the company there was some financial fracturing. I mean, things weren't going real well. Can you talk a little bit about why Dungeons & Dragons, why TSR wasn't as successful a company as the game perceived it to be?
Well, the company was wildly successful, at least in terms of revenues, because the game did take off. They sold lots of copies. They started making new editions and other books and supplements, things that added on to the game and made it bigger, and they started making money. They were just raking in the cash. The problem was that so many of the guys involved with this company, they were gamers. they didn't have a lot of business experience. Gary Gygax had been an insurance salesman and, you know, he had had his small business repairing shoes, but he was not a startup guy. He was not an experienced manager. And the same was true of other people at the company. So when all this cash started coming in and the company is really flush with money, what happened is that the company started spending the money, often in very strange and questionable ways. They bought a bunch of subsidiaries. TSR, the company that published Dungeons & Dragons, bought a company that did needlework patterns, which really isn't at all central to their business model. But I guess the thinking was, oh, we can have D&D-themed needlework patterns. That's true, but that probably was not the best business decision. One of my favorite stories I came across while researching the book is that they briefly considered buying a railroad. There was a disused railroad corridor that went between Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, where the company was, and downtown Chicago. And members of the company, some of the folks said, well, we could buy that, we could set up trains, and we could run game trains. You would get on board at Chicago, and by the time you got to Lake Geneva, you could play through a whole Dungeons & Dragons adventure. That might have been fun, but the railroad business is a tough and extremely expensive one. Thankfully, saner heads prevailed on that. But this kind of spendthrift spending and also, you know, not knowing exactly what to do with the company, it quickly led to internal conflict. The different people who owned pieces of the company and who had interests in it started to fight with each other and break into different groups. A lot of it was based on, you know, just family. You know, I'm with my brother on this. We own X amount of shares in the company and you don't. And it got ugly pretty quickly.
And Gary Gygax, you write in the book, moved to Hollywood and wanted to take the TSR Dungeons & Dragons brand and turn it into a big entertainment monopoly. But that didn't work out real well for him, did it?
No, not that well. I mean, what happened was after a point, the company clearly fractured into two main sort of interest groups. There was Gary Gygax's side of the company, and there was the Bloom brothers. There were two guys who owned a big chunk of the company themselves. And Gygax and the Blooms stopped getting along so well, and so Gygax kind of threw his hands up at some point and was like, you know what? I'm going to go out to the West Coast. I'm going to expand this brand. He had the right idea. I mean, Dungeons & Dragons is a very strong fantasy brand. And so he said, we're going to have a D&D movie. The only thing that he really left Hollywood being able to point to is that there was a Dungeons & Dragons animated cartoon, which if you were a kid during the mid-1980s, you definitely remember that was a big deal. And it was very popular for at least a few years there, this D&D cartoon that ran on Saturday mornings. But aside from that, and the film never happened, there was rumors that there were scripts. And for a while, you know, Gary was saying that people like Orson Welles had gotten involved, but nothing ever happened. And Gary kind of had to go back to Lake Geneva after a while with very little to show for it.
So what ultimately happened to Gary Gygax and his relationship with TSR? Because now the Dungeons & Dragons brand is owned by a different company, Wizards of the Coast.
When Gary came back to TSR, he wasn't going to put up with other people telling him how to run his company anymore. So he found some outside investors and had them buy a chunk of shares of the company again and install him as CEO. The woman who he'd found to back this effort, however, her name was Lorraine Williams, and she was an heir to a publishing fortune. So she had a lot of money. When Lorraine backed Gary and brought him back to the company, she actually came in a management capacity and started looking at the books at TSR. And she very quickly realized just sort of how much financial malfeasance there had been and how poorly the company was run. And at some point she decided, you know what, I don't think Gary should be running this company either. So she did an end run around him. She bought more shares of the company. She bought out the Bloom brothers, and then she kicked Gary out too. She took over, and she ran the company for years after ejecting Gary with mixed results. You know, the company went on to make a lot of money doing a lot of things. They were very big in publishing for a long time, putting out fantasy books. They had lots of bestsellers that they put out, D&D fantasy books. But they ran into more troubles again. You know, eventually, they ran into inventory problems. The market for D&D fiction collapsed. People stopped buying the rules. And the company was on the verge of bankruptcy when Wizards of the Coast, who was a small sort of startup game company in Seattle, came in and bought the whole company lock, stock, and barrel and then moved it off to the West Coast.
David Ewalt is the author of the book Of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons & Dragons and the people who play it. We have to take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Terry Gilday, in for Doug Fabrizio. My guest is David Ewalt. He's the author of the book Of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons & Dragons and the people who play it. David, I want to enter a couple of comments from Twitter here. We have Jeremy on Twitter who asked this question. It's a good one. How has Dungeons & Dragons impacted the evolution of contemporary play? Is the legacy of D&D itself as great as its effects on other media?
It's huge. I mean, this is a game that is interesting not just because of its business story and, you know, the cultural landmark that it's become, but because it invented entirely new styles of gaming and a language for gaming and play that we just didn't have before. If you play video games nowadays, the games you play day to day owe a huge debt to Dungeons & Dragons, just starting with okay, let's say you play a video game where you're playing a hero, a knight or a drug dealer or a cop or whatever that character is. That was an innovation, that idea that you're just going to control one hero and that that hero will persist through a fantasy landscape and that that hero will level up and become stronger over time and develop. That was an innovation that really was introduced by Dungeons & Dragons. And then there's things like hit points. If you ever played a video game, you know your characters have hit points, that they only get hit so many times until they fall down, they're hurt. Hit points came from Dungeons & Dragons. And lots of things like the archetypes. We talked about how an adventure party might have a cleric and a wizard and a thief. Those class archetypes appear all the time in video games. And in a larger sense, this idea of let's have an adventure that is open and that we can explore and that we can sort of write as we go, that was a pretty fundamental innovation that has tempered all kinds of decisions in the world of play and gaming and really inspired so many people to go out and make their own games.
You have a really wonderful chapter in the book called Why We Play, and you assert some sort of positive social effects that come from playing Dungeons & Dragons and maybe how people react differently in a group when there's a central task they're trying to accomplish than they do as individuals or in other environments. Talk to me about that. What are the positive social effects positive social dynamics from playing a game like D&D?
Well, one of the main things is that you do sit down at a table with people and you very quickly form these strong bonds with them. I mean, if you think about it, you know, what happens when you meet, let's say you meet a group of five strangers at a party. You have to small talk. You have to figure out something. You know, you have to look for things that you have in common, and it's not always easy to create that sort of social connection. And you have to work hard on that specific thing. When you're playing Dungeons & Dragons, those five or six strangers can sit down at the exact same table. There's no small talk. You don't have to worry about, well, how am I going to relate to these people? You start concentrating on the game. But because the game makes you all have a common goal, because you're collaborating, you start to work together and you start to think of each other as friends. Even though you've never really met in the real world, inside the game, you are friends and you have to rely on each other. So that experience really bonds people together in a surprising way. And by the end of the adventure, you end up being friends in the real world because you were thrown into this sort of weird accelerated version of, okay, be friends now and cooperate. You also, because you're in this fantasy, you've lived vicariously through your players, through the characters. So when your characters have a triumph, when you do kill the dragon or save the princess, that sense that you get from that, it's like that sense of joy and achievement, you take that back to the real world. So it's not just, oh, your wizard and my thief killed the dragon. It's, hey, Bob, you and me, we killed the dragon. We're brothers now. Like we went on an adventure together. And it creates these social bonds that are pretty unique and often very, very strong. People who play these games, they make friendships that last for lifetimes.
And you've made some solid friendships with the folks you play with in New York. And also you have some great scenes in the book where you're in San Francisco on business or you're in London and you kind of link into the online community and find a game to play, right?
Yeah, it was very cool to discover just how sort of easily these communities come together. When I was a kid, I played with the guys who were already my friends. It was my friends from grade school, and we played D&D and other role-playing games together. When I came back to the game years later, I went on Craigslist. I found a random listing on Craigslist of, like, here's some guys looking to play Dungeons & Dragons. They were all like me. They were all guys who were in their late 20s, early 30s at that point, who were nostalgic for the game and wanted to get back together. I very quickly became friends with these guys, friends outside of the role-playing game world. You know, we now, you know, we'll go to movies, we'll go to dinner, you know, we'll hang out with each other. I mean, I've been to these guys' weddings now after this. And the same is true traveling around the world reporting the book. You know, if I was, you know, I'm reporting on stories for Forbes, I might have gone to London for work and said, hey, while I'm here, let me find out if there's a D&D game and look online. And it says, oh, here, there's a bar. And on Sunday afternoon, too, they're going to be playing Dungeons & Dragons there. And you go and you're just welcome. And you very rapidly get to know these people and have fun. And it's a secret for travelers now. I recommend that to people who just like to travel. Like, if you want to get to know a city, go find a Dungeons & Dragons game, play with the folks there, and then suddenly you have like six friends who live in that city. And after the game is over, they're going to be like, well, let me show you my favorite restaurant. Let me show you this cool bar. Oh, let me take you to my favorite museum. It's a really great way to get to know people.
I mean, you've conquered a forgotten realm together, right? So finding out where the best restaurant is kind of, you know, second is an easy thing to do after accomplishing that task together, right?
And, you know, you saved me. That dragon almost killed me. I will definitely drive you to the airport. That's no problem whatsoever.
So we talked a little bit about the social stigmatism of the game as a teen and, you know, leaving it in high school when you were a little insecure, as we all are, about kind of who we are and where we're headed. Is there any stigmatism that you deal with playing it as an adult? How does your wife feel about it? I mean, these are questions that I'm sure some of our listeners are interested in.
I'm lucky that my wife has been supportive, and she didn't know what Dungeons & Dragons really was, which is a frequent when people seem to have issues with the game, frequently it's just because they don't actually know what it is, and maybe the only perception they do have is from those weird news stories in the 1980s, or because they saw the 60-minute report or that bad Tom Hanks movie. So, you know, I did have to have a conversation with my wife when I started playing again, where I just told her, okay, this is what it is. I'm not running around in the woods with a sword killing people. It's all fantasy, and it's moderated, and it's normal. But I have run into some folks who, you know, their significant others aren't as supportive, or people think it's weird. But, you know, at some point, especially when you start to play the game, you realize this is so awesome. Like, it really is a lot of fun, and I'm getting something out of it that I don't care if people are going to give me a weird look when they see me reading this book in public, because I know something they don't. I know how cool this is.
And it's not like a poker game. I mean, you don't come home winning or losing money, I guess, right? So
yeah, I mean, that's the great thing too, is that, yeah, I mean, there's no real harm to it. I mean, if I had told my wife, hey, every Tuesday I'm going to go join a poker game with my friends, she wouldn't have had a problem with that either. But I could very easily have lost the rent money for that month. I'm not losing anything playing Dungeons & Dragons. I'm only winning.
Terry on Twitter says, I played D&D as a teen and just had my boys playing this summer as a way to disconnect from electronics. And In your travels with the book, have you seen a lot of parents sort of passing down their love for Dungeons & Dragons and role-playing games to their kids?
Yeah, this is something really cool that's happening now, because the people who played Dungeons & Dragons in the 80s when they were kids in its heyday are now grown up and having their own kids and starting to teach the game to them. And it's fun not just because they're passing on this hobby to a new generation, but because it is a social game. How many opportunities do you get as a parent to sit down with your kids and they will stay at that table for 6 hours? They're not going to want to get up and go get on the computer or watch some TV or go, you know, they're going to want to sit at that table with you and do an activity with you and concentrate on working on something together. It's such a great family activity, and as more and more people are discovering that, you know, I've met people who are running after school programs for their kids. They'll go in and teach other kids in a school how to play D&D so their kids have someone to play with. I've seen teachers talk about how they want to use it in classrooms, because it's so great for a kid, and it captures their attention in a way that's really hard to find in this day and age.
So what's the future of Dungeons & Dragons? Is it alive and well today? Is its popularity on the rise, do you think?
I think it is on the rise. The game kind of went fallow for a while. I mean, it's been published nonstop since the 1970s. The game has never gone away, but it certainly had moments where it dwindled in popularity. At the moment, though, I think it's on a comeback, in part because of that sort of nostalgic aspect of parents wanting to play it with their kids, and or just of parents, you know, or people in their 30s or 40s saying, I just want to play it myself with my friends. But also, I think the rise of video games have sort of weirdly turned people back on to tabletop games like this. If you have only ever played video games, maybe you're a kid or maybe you're an adult who played things like World of Warcraft or Skyrim, you play on your Xbox, those owe so much to Dungeons & Dragons that people are now turning around and discovering Dungeons & Dragons. They're like, oh, I see, this is where it all came from. And then they realize that D&D offers things that video games don't, that you have this true freedom, that the game can go anywhere and that it's limitless. And so that's drawing more players into the game. The game is currently owned by Hasbro, the big toy maker. They own Wizards of the Coast, and they're currently working on a new edition of the game, which is probably going to be published early next year. And they, I think they intend for this game to be very mainstream, for the new edition to bring in all the old fans and also to draw in a whole lot of new players.
Is it a hard sell for teens, though, who can have that experience with World of Warcraft online? You mentioned some of the things that are attractive about bringing kids back, but what would you say to a teen who tells you Dungeons and Dragons, that's kind of old fogey stuff? I mean, I get the same experience with World of Warcraft.
It is a hard sell until they try it. I mean, I've talked to a lot of teens and seen a lot of kids go through this, and they don't want to sit down at first because they are used to the high-definition graphics, the cool 3D look of everything on their Xbox, and, you know, it seems so lame to sit down at a table and, what, we're just going to have paper and pencils? Are you kidding me? I don't want to do that. But then when they try it, I've seen this little light go on behind their eyes because they realize, hey, wait a minute, no game. Every game is pre-programmed. Every video game I do, there's a finite set of options. It tells you, okay, you can turn left or you can turn right. In this game, I can turn left, I can turn right, I can dig a hole, I can do whatever I want to do. And they really respond to that. Kids who like games almost inevitably also like Dungeons & Dragons. I don't think a lot of kids are going to give up video games because video games are still pretty great. But everyone I've met so far who's tried it of these kids, if they're a video gamer, they're also going to like Dungeons & Dragons.
And David, real quickly, what's your personal future with the game? Are you still getting everything out of the game that you got out of it when you were 10?
I am. I have finished the book now. I've got this out in the world, but I'm still going and meeting up with my friends every week, and we're still playing the game because I still get this great a social experience out of it. And actually more so even than when I was a kid, because when you're a kid, you see your friends all the time. You see them at school. You see them on the weekends. I don't have a lot of opportunities to hang out around a table and goof off with my friends anymore, but every other week I get to do that now in Dungeons & Dragons, and it's as awesome as it ever was.
David Ewalt writes for Forbes and is the author of the book Of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons & Dragons and the people who play it. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Our executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. I'm Terry Gilday.